Hi, this is Marina Rocks, and you're listening to KPFT Houston.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. I'm your host today, Eric Heen, backed up by the most talented team on radio, and every week on So What's Your Story, we feature guests who'll come in here and take us on magical journeys through their stories. So let's get right to it. Well, our guest today is Jasmine Cardenas. Jasmine is an award-winning Colombian-American storyteller, actress, educator, and arts activist. Jasmine regularly tours her Spanish bilingual program, Cuentos from the Americas, which highlights lesser-known folk tales and legends to libraries, schools, and festivals across the country. Together with working Chicagoans, Jasmine developed Workers' Teatro to harness the power of art in action for workers' rights. She's been featured in many storytelling festivals, and this year she'll be featured as a new voice at the big National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee, this October. Jasmine, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you so much for having me. It is a great honor to be included in this program with such an incredible list of invitees from your past. And I don't know Texas that well, so it's excellent to meet a Texan and the Texas community through your program. Thank you.
Yes. Well, Texas would love to know you better. Now, I see from your bio, Jasmine, that you're not just a storyteller and an actress just for entertainment purposes, but you're also involved in a multitude of worthy causes. Like, how would you summarize what you're hoping to accomplish through your theater and storytelling?
You know, I really love that my parents were so brave and left everything they knew in Colombia to pursue what they didn't have quite a grasp on. They had a hope and they had faith that they could do more with their lives, that they could provide better for their families. And when my parents were younger in Colombia, there was a lot of internal fighting. Our country has the largest number of displaced people within the country for many years. That was its record. But it also has a record of being the most joyful country, like the happiest place in the world, based on that one test they do of people. And I love being Colombian. And I also love being an American. I'm grateful. I wouldn't be a storyteller professionally if I wasn't born right here, because this is not the kind of career choice I would have had as a little Colombian girl. So I just love that my parents had that courage to pursue something better for us. And having been raised in this glorious and complicated country, I think that we're a lot more alike than we are different. I think that the beauty is the diversity of language and food and culture and traditions and rituals. And I don't think that we need to be a place where we have to assimilate and forget who we are to appreciate our culture as Americans.
Exactly.
I love apple pie, and I love crossing our country in our car, you know, and traveling Route 66 and seeing all the little towns and learning about the Appalachian community, as well as the, you know, I remember the first time I went to California, I was laughing because I kept reading the signs in Espanol. And then my Californian friends would be like, "Oh yeah, that's, you know, Palo Alto." And I'd be like, "Palo Alto? You mean Palo Alto?" You know, I love that we are a mix. And so I think that with story, we can really better identify as human beings and see each other's humanity and ideally build bridges and not walls, but communities of friendship and understanding, because I think there's enough for everyone. I don't think we have to have a mindset of scarcity. I think that the world is abundant, and I think that there is enough for all of us, and nobody has to go hungry. I think that there's also a lot of greed, and that we should all be really active citizens, which is why I do a lot of social justice work, because I think that we can be really complacent, either because we're really comfortable and we don't have to worry about certain problems because they don't affect us, we think, or because we're just fighting to survive, and like you have to have two and three jobs to feed your kids. So it's hard to get civically engaged in things because you feel like they're outside of your periphery, they're outside of your control, and you really just got to get food on the table. But I think that we all need to be engaged, and I think that we can do it. And if no one person has to hold everything, if everyone offers a little, si todos portan de a poquito, hay bastante para todos, hay suficiente. If everyone gives a little, there's enough for everyone.
Yes, that's very good advice. I love your positive attitude, Jasmine. That's just what this country needs right now, how you open up to everybody. I love that. Okay, well, you are a professional storyteller, and that's the reason you're here. So let's hear a story.
Absolutely. I'm going to tell you a story from when I was a teenager. It is a true story. It did happen to me. It's part of my life experience. It's called My Brother's Keeper. A teenager works to free Manuel Salazar on death row. He shot a cop. No, he didn't. It says that the gun was in the officer's hands when it went off. Some forensic test shows that. Then why did he run Jazz? This was my friend Mari and I going back and forth as to whether or not we thought that this young Mexican American guy was innocent. His name was Manuel Salazar, and it was 1993. He was on death row, and we were sophomores in high school. We were deciding if we wanted to tell a story at the annual Aspira banquet. Aspira is a Latino youth leadership program that is still exists today, and every year clubs from around the city would gather and celebrate a year of community service, and we'd perform for each other. And Mari wanted us to do a sexy merengue dance choreography. Come on, Jazz! I think we have enough guys to do a bomb diggity sexy merengue. I know, Mari, but this guy's on death row and he's innocent, and we should tell his story. This would be totally different than anything anyone else is gonna do. Ah, but you're such a Debbie Downer, Jazz. Our friend and fellow club member, Ali, had met Manuel Salazar's lawyer, and she had told Ali all about Manuel and how there was international support for his freedom, and that his original trial had been rigged, and that Manuel had been represented by a lawyer, a shady lawyer, who was working for the same police department as the officer who had died. Our friend was like, you guys, this is wild. Even the Pope is behind him. And I said, yeah, he was just driving in a car with other Latino and Black kids, and this cop pulled him over for no reason. And then the cop beat him. There's proof that Manuel's innocent. And the lawyer says that people all over the world thinks he's innocent. And, you know, we could like interview the lawyer and tell Manuel's story. Oh, that's such a downer, Jazz. Come on. Why don't we do work on this dance and act it out and dance it out? And we could wear sexy Taino costumes. Guys, sexy Taino Indian costumes from the island? No. You guys, this could be any one of us in the car with our friends. Now, this I knew to be true. You see, just that summer before school started, my brother Fabian and I, we were driving down the middle of this road. It's called Irving Park in Chicago. And we were driving in my mom's station wagon, and I had seen a friend of mine walking on the road. So I leaned over and started honking on the horn to get her attention, just as my brother was getting to the intersection. And when we got through it, the Cadillac in front of us, he stopped all crazy about it. And I guess this guy must have thought we were honking at him, because this older white guy in dress slacks and a white collar shirt jumps out of the car, raging mad. Fabian was starting to opening the window to talk to him and tell him that, this was we were not honking at him. It was just his crazy little sister. But this guy's his face was crazy red with rage. And I tell my brother, no, Fabian, don't open the door. Don't open the window. He was yelling all sorts of things. F this, F that, calling us stupid Mexicans. We're actually Colombian. But Fabian opened the window anyway. The guy kept yelling at us, and suddenly he reached into the car and punched my brother in the face.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he broke his nose. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I was sitting in the car when that happened. We rushed my brother home, and my mom and dad rushed him to the children's hospital called Children's Memorial near us. We got the license plate of that guy, and even though we got all that information, they did nothing to that guy. The police report did nothing. This could have been any one of us in a car with our friends. I told them, we gotta like stand up for Manuel. We gotta tell a story. So I did get the girls to agree that we would at least go and talk to the lawyer and learn more. We went to the office on Blue Island and 18th Street in the neighborhood called Pilsen in Chicago. There's a giant banner, and it said, for the defense of Manuel Salazar outside. I remember it clear as day. And we walked up this tiny staircase, and upstairs, the room was full of people on the phone, stuffing envelopes and flyers, typing things up. And the lawyer, her name is Marlene Kamish, she sat us down and told us all about the incident, how the official police report had stated that the car was suspicious because there were Negroes and Hispanics in the car together.
Whoa.
That was written in the report about how Manuel had an unregistered gun inside of his gym bag. And the thing is, he'd been out target practicing with friends in a forest. So when they got pulled over by the cop, he got really nervous and ran out of the car, and how the officer started to chase him. And Manuel took that gym bag with the unregistered gun inside and threw it over a fence so that it would be on the other side. And he turned around and put his hands up. And that's when the cop began to beat him. Even as Manuel said, I give, I give. She told us about how Manuel acted in self-defense and how the autopsy report showed that the gunpowder was in the officer's hands when it went off, proving that the gun was in the police officer's hands when it went off.
Wow.
I started to feel like we were in a movie, like all these details were flying at us. My friends and I were silent on the edge of the couch. And then after that gun went off, Manuel was stunned, and she said that he ran off to a friend's house. But when he got there, his friends didn't recognize him. They said that he looked like Frankenstein from the beating he'd received. Then she told us about how the police department, the Joliet Police Department, put a shoot to kill order out on Manuel's life.
Oh my God.
Manuel, who was just 18 years old, was very scared, and he ran off to Mexico. But then a few months later, he was sleeping in the middle of the night in a little ranchito in Mexico when masked men who'd been paid $5,000 came in for him and dragged him out. They paid at the border to illegally extradite him into the United States, which violated the extradition treaty between the US and Mexico. And it turned out that, like, the lawyer found out that actually the Manuel's first attorney, he had represented Manuel in the first trial, but he didn't introduce important critical evidence into the trial. So there was no witness. There were no witnesses. There was no toxicology report or testimony from the toxicologist confirming the officer's blood alcohol level and showing that he was in fact drunk.
Wow.
So Manuel was convicted and they put him on death row. And Manuel found out while he was in prison that that attorney had been suspended from the practice of law. We were sitting there listening to this like it was a movie. And then she starts telling us that there were members of the British Parliament who were on Manuel's side. Amnesty International, even the Pope, were all in support of freeing Manuel, and at least giving him a second trial. And what one thing that just blew me away was that while he was in prison, he had started painting, because he was on death row. He didn't have as many opportunities to leave the cell sometimes, and he was entirely self-taught. But his paintings that she showed us were amazing.
Wow.
She told us that she showed us one that was called My Brother's Keeper, and it just broke my heart to see the image of a big human eyeball, and in the very center is a person in the fetal position, and then there are these bars across the front of the painting.
Oh, wow.
I looked at my girlfriends and I, and everyone was teary-eyed. We were convinced we had to tell Manuel's story. So together, with the help of like these young theater professionals who just graduated from college, we started to create a play. We were all in high school, but we'd never written a play before, but we used those paintings and the poetry from his pieces, and we called it Reflections, the story of Manuel Salazar. And that's when the five of us became his story. We'd acted out being different characters. Sometimes I was Manuel, sometimes I was the cop, sometimes someone was the judge, and we'd do the images of like those prison bars with our body. We created this dream sequence to show how Manuel ran and all the violence and
wow.
How he ended up in death row. So the last line of this play says, "Let us stop blinding ourselves from the suffering of others and take the time to care. For I ask you to ask yourself, ¿Acabo no soy yo el guardián de mi hermano? Am I or am I not the keeper of my brother?"
Oh my God.
I have to tell you, Eric, that when we performed that for the leadership group, that Aspida group, they loved it. We did not show up with a Taino dance. We told Manuel's story and we got a standing ovation. And while everybody else clapped really nice for the merengues and the salsas that were performed, we felt really proud. And Marlene, the lawyer, she was there and she watched the show.
Wow.
And she was blown away, so blown away that she set up all these other opportunities. Remember, we're just high school kids doing an after school club, and we do this one event that we think we're going to do, and that's it. But then we started traveling with her and with Manuel's paintings, and we started going like public events and private events. I was in the Mexican Independence Day parade marching alongside Manuel's mom and his family, and then we got like more actively involved volunteering in his case, and I would go up those stairs and write those letters and stuff those envelopes. And, you know, I even got to become pen pals with Manuel. It was just wild. So my sophomore year and my junior year were completely wrapped up with these performances and, you know, visiting Manuel at the Pontiac Correctional Center, getting to know his family better. But then, you know, that senior year, life just got really busy with college applications and sports and the drama team and like all these things that, you know, while my mom had been busy chauffeuring us around to do these things, my friends started dropping away because they had other things to do. And then I eventually also did.
Sure.
And we just lost touch.
Right.
And I was in college, well into college. I believe I was in my junior year when a school from that same Pilsen community came to my university to ask if there was somebody that could teach an after school drama program. And being the only Latina in my entire theater department, my professors looked at me and said, "Jasmine, this might be great for you." And so I started to travel to the very far south side of the city, which Pilsen is not the very far south side. But if you know the layout of Chicago, I was in school in Evanston, which is a northern suburb. So I would cross the city and then have to go just past downtown into this community. And I loved working with those kids. They were so fun. But then near the end of our program together, they wanted to perform. And I showed them the script of Reflections that we had written when I was a high school student. And they loved it. And they said, "We want to do this. What happened to Manuel?" And I suddenly had this deep guilt because I had been busy enjoying college and I had no idea what had happened to him.
Oh, man.
So my mom, who had been remembered chauffeuring us around, remembered where Marlene lived because she dropped us off there sometimes or picked us up there if we had done an event with Marlene. And so we show up totally unannounced. It's like 8 o'clock at night, and I knock on this woman's door. You know, it's been like 4 years since she's seen me, and she could not believe that I was standing there and that I was now a young woman. And she told me that Manuel had been given his second trial and that he had won it and he was free.
Oh, man.
I was so blown away. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to talk to him, so she gave me his phone number and we reconnected. He invited me out to his home. I remember I was out in Joliet at his mom's house, and he's like making me Mexican breakfast with huevos and chorizo. And we were just talking and chatting about and catching up. And I was so nervous, but I told him, "We're doing your play. Will you come and see it?" And he was blown away. He said yes. The day he showed up at my university and watched these young teenagers that I had been directing, I was like so beyond nervous. I think mostly I was nervous that about what he would say, whether he would like it or not. It was his story, not mine, but it was this work that I had been doing. And like he sat there in his, I remember he was wearing like a V-neck pullover. And at the end of the show, he just was so quiet and surprised, and he said, "Thank you, Jasmine.
Wow.
Believe you did this. This is something else." So I know that I am not the British Parliament, I am not the Pope, but I do know that what we did for Manuel made a difference.
You know, I'm not the sentimental type, but that gets me right here. I mean, boy, that moment when you heard he got his freedom, that must have been something. Then he actually went and saw the play.
Full circle. It was such a
Yeah.
full circle moment.
And it seemed like it started out as just kind of a whim, you know. You were going to do the sexy dance, and you said, "Well, what about this?" And then you went through all that work for the play, the research, meeting with the attorney. I really got to hand it to you. It seems like you've been doing that ever since.
Thank you, Eric. I have to say that I feel like we are all capable of doing this, right? Because just like you said, we're just a bunch of teenagers deciding if we do one thing or if we do another thing. And really it just depends on whether or not you're passionate about it and if it's bigger, is it
Yeah.
something that's bigger than yourself? And can you help someone?
Oh, yeah. We're going to take a break from our show for station identification and to make a few announcements. You're listening to So What's Your Story here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Our show is sponsored by the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild puts on numerous storytelling events, including a monthly story swap the fourth Tuesday of every month that everyone is invited to attend. For more information about the Guild, go to HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're on that same website, click on the link to our program, So What's Your Story? And you'll see archives from our show dating all the way back to 2008. And we're also on Facebook. Just go to So What's Your Story on Facebook for more information and updates about our radio show. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. The Moth holds monthly story slams the second Tuesday of every month down at the Warehouse Live on Emanuel Street. The next slam will be held on July 11th, and the theme for that night's stories will be sweat. So if you have any sweaty stories, go to the Moth, July 11th. Now, Jasmine, much of your work centers around the idea that you have your foot in like two different cultures here, Colombian and American. So does this multiculturalism background, does that help you to connect with kids who are immigrants?
Oh my gosh, so much. I didn't realize that the feelings that I felt as a little girl, and I felt alone sometimes, or that they were uniquely my problem, were not just my problem. That in fact, if you're half Romanian because your parents are Romanian, but you're born here, that you're also going to feel the same tug because your parents speak this other language and your friends at school don't get it. And then they eat different kinds of foods and your friends are like, that smells weird. Or, you know, it just is a true reality that when you come from different cultures, not all the things are the same. And so my struggle all my life, feeling like I was neither from here and neither from there, ended up helping me realize that actually that's true for lots of us. And it's actually true for all of us when we think about the ways that you behave or the community that you might have, say, at school versus the community that you have at home. You have a different thing. People care about different things in those places. Or maybe your community at church is very different from your school community. So there, those are cultures, those are social cultures. But when you're a kid whose family speaks a different language, it becomes even more amplified. And so for years I've been performing this piece called my show called Cuentos from the Americas. And having performed this piece now in multiple states and in so many classrooms and libraries, I see over and over again that the children respond to it. I'm talking about Mexican kids and Colombian kids, Ecuadorian kids and Polish kids, and I've had Japanese kids say to me, "This, you know, that happened to me too." You know, because everyone thought that you know, my kimchi smelled funny. I think this was a cute little Korean kid one day told me this because he would have a thermos with his food in it. And so my show, Cuentos from the Americas, tells folk tales and ancient myths and legends from this hemisphere, because we are in this hemisphere. And so North America, Central America, and South America is just an incredible wealth of culture and story and history. And we rarely hear those stories. So being a little girl who grew up in Chicago, I always heard the Little Red Hen and the Gingerbread Man, and I love the Three Little Pigs. And I can tell the tale off of the Three Little Pigs in a bilingual version, but I never heard stories like El Hombre Caiman, which is the Crocodile Man from Colombia, or and I never heard of the colibri, how the hummingbird came to be, and that there's Mayan stories that tell us these beautiful creation stories. And so my show focuses on that. It is bilingual and I get to perform it all over the place. And I feel really blessed by that. I wasn't always a bilingual teller. I just was a storyteller. I didn't realize that my bilingualism could be so important.
Does your approach to storytelling, is it different when you tell in Spanish or English? Because I speak German, and I've noticed when I speak German, I'm like a different person than when I speak English. So is it different for you when you tell stories in Spanish versus English?
I agree with that, Eric. I do feel there's a Latina version of me. There's this like Colombian version of me, and then there's this like American version of me. But you know what is so funny is that there is a different energy when I tell completely in Espanol, than versus when I tell in English. And then there's a really the like the reason telling in Spanish and English is so important to me is because of how it happened for me. I had graduated from college. I was storytelling by going into schools and telling bilingual, sorry, telling in like traditional American folk tales like the Three Little Pigs with a tandem teller. And then so what would happen is we'd tell the story and then we'd bring the children out. We'd act out the story. So there was some creative drama. And then we would bring the children out onto something called the Story Bus, which was a children's museum on wheels. And so that was an English experience when I started that job. But we walked into this school on the north side of the city. It was a Catholic school. And this teacher comes up to us and she's like, "Oh, my kids are so excited. They can't wait for you to come." And they love stories. They're incredible listeners and they're all ready for you. Well, they are all really good listeners, except Elmer. Don't worry about him. He does his own thing. Elmer is this little boy. So my teller and I, my partner, Amy Ressler, who by her own right is an incredible storyteller and was a mentor of mine growing up, we end up on this job together and she and I are telling the Three Little Pigs. And I can see that Elmer is so disengaged. He has a pencil and he is digging it into one of those carpets that have a rainbow on it that the kids are all sitting on. And he has his back to us. And I'm trying to get him involved. I'm like, "Little pig, you know, trying to be the wolf." And he is so uninterested. And then At one point, I say, "Cochinito, cochinito, déjeme entrar." He turns around and his eyes are so huge, Eric, that I knew I had him. And he said it, "Cochinito, cochinito, déjeme entrar." And he like stood up and he became the wolf instantly. And I look at my partner and her eyes are as big as Elmer's, but she's in shock. She doesn't know what I've said or what's next. And I said, little pig, let me come in." And so I'm like, "Pig?" And she's like, "Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin." And I'm helping the kids, "Ni por la pelusita de mi barbilla, barbilla." I'm looking for the words in Spanish as I'm saying the phrases. And this kid is blowing the house down. And by the end of the story, the pigs were bilingual as the wolf was. Like we were learning these phrases. And it was about necessity of understanding. And when that story was done and the teacher, we were pulling the kids out onto the bus, the teacher says, "I don't know how you did that. Elmer has never been so engaged."
Wow.
And I'm telling you, Eric, in that moment, I went to a strong memory that I had. I forgot I had had this memory, but it immediately filled my brain. And it was when I was a 5-year-old little girl and I was in kindergarten. I was also at a Catholic school. And I remember I was coloring on the table on those big fat crayons that they had in kindergarten classrooms. And I remember I was coloring in a page when my parents walked in, and my dad was very serious, and I knew something like was happening. And what I remember, my teacher, who was a nun, she said, "Mr. and Mrs. Cardenas, we need Jasmine and Fabian," that was my big brother, "to learn to speak English. So you need to stop speaking to them in Spanish at home so they can learn English quickly." And my dad stood up and in very broken English, he said, "Mi familia, we are from Colombia. We speak Spanish in home. You speak English in school. We speak Spanish at home. How we speak with our children if we no speak your language?" And I just remember so strongly that feeling of being a scared little girl and then feeling protected by my dad. Not because my kindergarten teacher was a bad person or that she treated me badly, because she didn't. She was a wonderful teacher, but she didn't understand that this was our family's language and it was important. And that moment gave me the okay to hold on to my language. And also to learn English, but also to keep speaking Spanish because it was important. And that little boy, Elmer, his teacher, her classroom changed over the course of that year. There was more there, every time we came, because with that program, I'd return to the school 3 times. By the end of that year, there was labeling, ventana, window, puerta, door. This was 20 years ago. And there was like all this labeling. And I remember the very last time he ran up to me with a book in his hand and he said, "Como mi familia, Miss Jasmine, como mi familia," which means like my family, Miss Jasmine, like my family. And it was a book about making tamales for Christmas. Elmer, this little Latino boy, became a leader in his classroom and became so engaged because they met him halfway, right? And so I really approach my storytelling, my bilingual telling, with that purpose, to try to help it make it understandable for children whose primary language is Spanish. I wish I could speak other languages and also do it in Polish and also do it with, Japanese. And my attempt to bridge those gaps is that if I'm in a school, like there's this incredible community in Chicago that has like Taiwanese children mixed in with Korean children. It's like a whole Pacific, Southwest, Southeast Pacific community, like Asia. There's like a Muslim community mixed in. And suddenly those pigs and wolves speak. They say cochinito, cochinito in Arabic. And then the other kid responds in Thai. And like my hope is that kids feel like their language matters, their community matters. And it's beautiful. Because our communities are beautiful, all of our communities.
Now, I think that shows that good storytellers, they don't just recite words. They really adapt to the moment while they're telling their stories. And that's what you did with that Elmer guy. And it changed his life.
I'm telling you, I really saw the change in that classroom. I saw a teacher see her difficult student. She labeled him, you know, unengaged, disengaged. I saw her adjust her perception of him and then include him in special ways in the class, even though he was the only child that was primarily Spanish speaker because he just immigrated. She did add words in Spanish in her class. He didn't have to do that because that wasn't a prerequisite. The law did not require her to do that at that time, but she did it because she wanted to include him. And I think that we can all do that for our kids, whether it's a neighborhood kid that you see on your block who's isn't engaged because the other kids won't play with him. You could be the person to step in and include him to help you, you know, plant some plants in front of your house so that you don't have to use language to talk to each other. You can use movement and symbols and, you know, made up signs to talk to each other.
Sure. I love your approach. That's perfect. Now, you're also very much involved in workers' rights, I've noticed. What have you been doing in that arena lately, Jasmine?
Well, you know, I was working on a play because I'm also an actor. And in this particular play, I was the assistant director. So I wasn't a performer in this play. But David Schwimmer was directing a show at Looking Glass Theater Company here in Chicago. And I've been a longtime teaching artist with Looking Glass. And so I asked to be on that project. And because it was a show that was about working people, it's called Beyond Caring. The company invited some worker groups to come and tell us their stories because this play had been adapted from its original setting. There was a company who created it in London, the UK, and now we were in Chicago and they wanted to make it Chicago specific and be about the United States. Sure. So I was in the room just listening to these workers, and some of them were Black speaking English, Black Americans, and some of them were Latinos speaking in Spanish and then being translated. And the level of abuse that they were talking about broke my heart.
Oh boy.
We're talking about factories right here in Chicago, in my neighborhood, in my communities, in our city surrounding areas. And they're talking about products that they're shipping or packing or baking that I buy at the grocery store that you and I might consume because we buy those things. Right. And I couldn't believe the level of abuse they were experiencing. So after that show wrapped up, I spoke to the company, to that organization, and I asked if I could use some theater techniques to work with them. And, you know, a long time ago, I studied with a man named Augusto Boal, and the technique of theater that I learned from him is called Theater of the Oppressed. And it's a form of theater, not for actors, but for regular people, not actors. It's about using our real life scenarios and trying to find solutions to problems. And so here I saw a major problem, the level of abuse that workers were experiencing, and I wasn't hearing really great solutions. They were fighting for them, but I also saw some workers whose pride, whose dignity had really been attacked, and who, you know, their eyes were down. I felt to me that they had succumbed to that violent energy that they were experiencing. So I started doing workshops with them. And this was just to see if they liked it. And Eric, it snowballed. They loved it. Because this technique of Theater of the Oppressed is about reclaiming your body, reclaiming your voice, and then thus reclaiming your power. Because you really have to be in your body to play the games, to be in relationship with each other in the space. And, you know, when you go to work, you just go through the motions. And if you don't really like being there, you kind of disassociate. And if people are treating you terribly and you know you deserve better, you just kind of disconnect yourself that, and you become like a monotonous zombie just going to work to get that paycheck because everybody needs a paycheck. But this technique requires you to be in your body and stand up. And so we started doing this work together, and like it's been almost 6 years now. And our group is independent. We're called Workers Teatro, and it's made up of Latino immigrant workers and Black workers. We perform in public spaces or we're invited, but we also just go to churches, schools, we go to the parks, we do interactive workshops, and everywhere we go, people feel, have these moments of feeling like they matter.
So now these aren't professional actors. These are just regular people. And
yes.
It's to sort of build up their confidence.
Yes. I will tell you that I am the only trained professional actor working with our team, but they are incredible performers because they're not telling somebody else's story. They're telling their own stories. So there's real agency. There's real passion because they know what it feels like to be talked to like that. When they step into the role of the oppressor, that the foreman on the line or the that's directing them and being mean to them, they know exactly which words to say because they had those words shouted at them. And
I
so
see how that would come across more authentic than if they were just making up fiction.
Oh yeah, it really is powerful. And we're in a tricky spot because it's hard for me to make this work sustainable. So I'm trying to figure out how to become an entity so that we can make it more sustainable for the entire team. Mostly it's been volunteer by everyone, except I'll write a grant and then I can kind of pay us. You know, I find an organization that wants to have us perform and then they pay us, you know, and then I share that. And I try to, because art is labor. And the time that they're with me rehearsing something, that means that they're not at home with their kids and they're not at their jobs working.
Right.
And time is money. So I'm trying to find a way to make it sustainable because art is labor and their time matters to me. And my time matters to me. When I'm with them, I'm not with my kids. I'm not with my husband. I'm not working at another job. And so we're in this growth spurt moment where we're trying to figure out how do we keep our collective to be, you know, inclusive and to be and to continue to do outreach work. And how do we make it sustainable? Because
you do have momentum. It is growing now. It is.
Yes. And it's been great. So we're going to be presenting at the Pedagogy and Theater of the Oppressed Conference in 3 weeks down in Indianapolis. And we've been invited by the University of Chicago. They were one of our partners last year. They have something called the School of Public Health. And within the School of Public Health, there's something called the Center for Healthy Work. And on my website, jasminecardenas.com, there's a tag that says Workers Teatro, and you can see some of the videos that we created to tell worker stories. And we're actually going to go to Miami to a conference about public health to share this work because it's workers' health and safety matters. And, you know, OSHA needs to hear these stories so that we can protect workers.
Yes, there's stuff going down there in Florida. I think they can use your help down there.
We hope so.
But I appreciate your efforts on that. That's just fantastic. So Jasmine, what inspired you to get into this field?
You know, Workers Teatro came out of that moment, hearing worker stories and being in full shock. But truly in working with them and trying to figure out how to best amplify their stories, I realized that, you know, I didn't have to start from scratch. And Teatro Campesino was developed by Luis Valdez in California during Cesar Chavez's migrant worker strikes when they were fighting around grapes and tomatoes and doing all of those incredible actions. And Teatro Campesino came from the people. And what I was doing with the workers was coming from the people. And I was really fortunate to work with him once. And, you know, I think that this is like divine movement of the stars and the moon and the sun, because in a workshop that I did with him in the 2000s, way before I started working with workers outright, he introduced something that I've never forgotten. And it's a Mayan precept that he uses in Teatro Campesino called Inlak Ech. And it goes like this. Yo soy tu otro tú. I am your other you. Tú eres mi otro yo. You are my other me. Si te hago daño a ti, if I do harm to you, me hago daño a mí misma, I do harm to myself. Si te amo y te respeto, if I love and respect you, me amo y me respeto yo, I love and respect myself. And that has been really a guiding message for me in my heart, in my personal life, but in this work especially, because we are ancient peoples, right? Your family from Europe, my family from this hemisphere and from the Spaniard that came over back in the 1400s. And we're all people on the same floating orb. And I just believe that kindness matters. And I believe that how we treat each other matters. And I believe that there's power in seeing each other's humanity and respecting each other. So
Fine.
that's been the kind of the, like some one of the heart pieces, the heart pumping pieces of Workers Teatro is being able to see your other you.
Yes. Really great way to connect with
Yeah,
people.
and our team, sometimes we perform and everyone's a Spanish speaker, but the audience is all English. And so we do translation work, we do movement physical work because I don't just use Theater of the Oppressed, but we have lots of ways of moving our bodies through viewpoints and dance and movement and all the things that I've trained, I bring to the team and we use it to help us communicate in whatever language we need to communicate in.
Yeah, super. Now, Jasmine, I see you performed a one-woman show, that this show called Nina Buena. So you've added playwright to your skills. And this new show you've developed and have performed a couple of times called Disposable. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. So Niña Buena was my coming of age story, and I was really fortunate to perform it at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, at different theaters in Chicago, and wherever I was kind of invited. I was able to perform it in Mexico at an international theater festival. This was a show I did 10 years ago. And then I was busy doing other projects. And when I started working with the workers, doing this workers' theater work, I started realizing that I am a disposable worker as
Wow.
an artist. I'm a precarious worker, and I was experiencing a lot of the struggles that they were. Except because I'm a professional, because I've gone to college for this work, and because I work in professional environments, the level of treatment is different. It's much more indignified work when you're doing hard labor work, and people can still treat you disposably when you're a white collar worker, but it just looks different. And so I started pursuing and researching that stuff. And then during the pandemic, the First Stage Theater in Tysons, Virginia invited me and 10 other BIPOC artists from around the country to write original solo shows because as a theater company, they weren't able to produce their year, right? They had a show, a whole season they had to cancel. So instead, they decided to support artists who were also struggling because of the pandemic. And so I started to write this idea that I had, and it turned into me interviewing many, many people across the country. And so I created a show that has five characters currently who are a mixture of blue collar workers and white collar workers, professional workers. And my hope is to show the similarities in their job precarity. Because if you are a gig worker or a contract for hire, it doesn't matter if you are an engineer or a scientist or trained scientist or a doctor or a nurse, even though you have job skills that required education, you don't have health insurance, you don't have any security, you don't have save you don't get to have a pension or anything to catch you if you hurt yourself. And because we've lost unions in our country in such a large amount, there's a lot of hard-fought protections that were won by workers as part of those union fights that are disappearing. And truly, I feel like my generation, I feel like we're the ones that need to fight to keep a bit of job security for ourselves. So I started building this play, and it's called Disposable. And so I invite you to invite anyone listening that would be willing to let me interview them, who happens to be a white collar worker, to come to my website, jasminecardenas.com. And my contact info is there. They could call me or they can email me. And maybe I'd be able to get 30 minutes of their time to interview them. I'm willing to do that as an anonymous person. I don't have to put your name in the script or anything if people are not comfortable with that. But because I am so specific a theater person, I don't know so many things about these other industries. And being able to talk to people directly who are working in those industries, it was a lot is what has allowed me to make the show really juicy and specific so that I'm not pretending to talk about a biomedical person because
Yeah.
I'm talking to a biomedical engineer who's telling me what it's like. So that's been exciting. My show Disposable is still in the works, but I already performed it in Zimbabwe and in South Africa because
Wow.
I won an award by the Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation last year to tour this new piece. And I'm telling you, when I performed this show in Zimbabwe, they said, "The Mexicans in your story are us when we go to South Africa."
Wow.
When I was in South Africa, the people said, "The South Africans here, we treat Zimbabweans the way Americans, the way you're treating Mexicans in your story," because they saw the similarities. It was powerful. So I think the plight for workers is a worldwide plight.
Yes.
So, and I think that we need to grab hands across the oceans and help each other amplify the stories, because there's no reason for us to be with so much want when there's so much out there. These corporations are making profits in the billions, and people have to have three jobs to feed their kids.
Yeah. Well, that shows how universal this is. Well, Jasmine, we're getting a little short on time here, but it's been great having you on our show. And now, again, your website is Jasmine Cardenas.
Yes. So
and
it's
no E in Jasmine. Jasmine.
Right. It's jasminecardenas.com. Jasminecardenas.com.
It's a great website. I've been all through it.
Thank you.
Do you have any final words of wisdom? Any parting thoughts for our listeners?
I would just say that we need to be kinder to ourselves, because the world is a hard place to be. And if we can just love ourselves a little bit better, maybe we'll be able to love each other a little bit better. And if we can find moments to be present, pause, and really breathe, because social media has us rushing and the jobs have us rushing and our kids have us rushing. And I think if we could be, and this is like for me as much as it is for anyone else, because I'm caught in the rat race too, to pause, take some breaths, and just love on ourselves, because we're all doing the best that we can.
Very good advice. Well, I appreciate everything you're doing, Jasmine, and thank you for being our guest here on So What's Your Story?
Thank you, Eric. It was a pleasure.
Bye. Well, that is our show for today, folks. I'd like to thank our guest storyteller, Jasmine Cardenas, for her stories and for all she does for folks up there in Chicago. And in honor of Jasmine's hometown, we're going to sign off tonight with the Blues Brothers singing Sweet Home Chicago. And don't you dare move, because Living Art is up next with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heem, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Come on. I feel like doing a nasty song. I hope you don't mind. And if you do, I got this microphone. It just kind of comes with it. Sorry.
KPFT artist profile, Carolyn Wonderland.
Well, when I was a kid, that was a radio station that I would listen to at night under my pillows and in the dark when I was, you know, I thought it was very subversive and I couldn't wait to escape my bedroom and come to the Montrose. So yeah, it was a beacon in the night, man. It's the first time I got to hear queer radio, first time I got to hear what was going on in the Texas prisons. I mean, to me, it's a, you know, it's a not just music, but it was information. It was stuff that I would have never heard in the suburbs. As soon as I had a chance, I moved as close to KPFT as I could.
Listen for her music and other local artists right here on KPFT.
Arnie here. Grab a pencil. Your checklist for 5 a.m. Turn off the alarm. Pull the covers over your head. Feed the baby. Clock out of work. Head to the drive-in for coffee and a breakfast burrito and turn on KPFT. The Attitude with Arnie Arneson is back. Radio that delivers life through the lens of politics and policy. But the operative word is life.
Tune into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, weekday mornings at 5 on KPFT.
Hi, this is Colleen from Howlin' the Blues, and here are a few music events headed our way. On Tuesday, June 13th, Dave Haas will be performing the 7 p.m. show at McGonagall's Mucky Duck, and Christopher Seymour and the Western Cosplay at the Big Top. On Wednesday, June 14th, Eric Lauer will be at Do-Si-Do Breakfast, Barbecue and Whiskey Bar, and Eric Korb will be at Rehab Bar. On Thursday, June 15th, Sonny Sweeney will be at Do-Si-Do Big Barn. Sir Woman and the Texas Gentleman will be appearing at Heights Theater. Sean Pittman at Katie's Bar. Jack Ingram at Main Street Crossing. Johnny Nicholas and Katie Shore will perform the 7 p.m. show at McGonagall's Mucky Duck, followed by Charlie Mars at 9:30. And Sunjammer, Garrett T. Capps, and NASA Country will be in Galveston at the Old Quarter Acoustic Cafe. On Friday, June 16th, the Sparky Parker Band will be at the Big Easy, Opie Hendricks at the Big Top, Sean Pittman at the Continental Club, James Wilhite and the Classics at Green Oaks Tavern, Gary Morris at Main Street Crossing, and McGonagall's Mucky Duck will have Robbie Fulks performing at 7 p.m., followed by Nora Jane Struthers at 9:30. On Saturday, June 17th, Holland K. Smith will be at the Big Easy, Hector Ward and the Big Time at the Continental Club, Cooper Wade at Do-Si-Do Big Barn, Kyle Hutton and Matt Parrish at Do-Si-Do Breakfast, Barbecue and Whiskey Bar, Sean Pittman at Green Oaks Tavern, Uncle Lucius at the Heights Theater, Zach Tate at Katie's, Fab Five at Main Street Crossing, Lisa Morales Band at McGonagall's Mucky Duck, Tony Vega Band at Rehab Bar, and Grifters and Shields will be having an album release party at the Big Top, along with the Mighty Orc. That's a glimpse of what's happening in our area. We include all genres of music, so if you'd like your event included in the KPFT music calendar, send as much information as far in advance as possible to blueshound@kpft.org, and we'll help you get the word out. Let's all do our part to support live music.
Hi, this is the Blues Hound.
And I'm Colleen.
Please join us on Sundays between the hours of 2 and 5 p.m. for Hound the Blues, where you'll hear us spinning the best new blues releases we can get our hands on. Whether it's the newest contemporary artist or simply old school cool, we'll bring the blues to you in all of its many flavors, commercial free and with as little talk as possible.
Thanks for inviting us into your homes each week and giving us the privilege to serve as your link to the blues world and our local blues community.
That's Hound the Blues, Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM KPFT. Houston's community station.